Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. As I said, in the studio is Dr. John Rich, who wrote the book Wrong Time, Wrong Place, Trauma and Violence in the Lives of Young Black Men. He's chair of the Department of Health Management and Policy at the Drexel University School of Public Health in Philadelphia, and he is a 2006 MacArthur Grant recipient. Roy Martin is with us, who is written about in the book, comes to life in this book. Now he's come to life in the studio. He's now a case manager at the Boston Public Health Commission. And John Rich and Roy Martin, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you.
Pleasure to be here.
Let me hear 410-319-8888 to join in on this conversation. Jump over to my Facebook page and you can join the conversation there. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com, 410-319-8888. I mentioned Dr. Carnell Cooper at the top of the hour because in Baltimore, the work he's done on shock trauma and kind of intervening in the lives of young men, mostly young men who have been shot, that come through the doors of shock trauma. Something similar to what you started, John Rich, but a little different twist. Talk about your twist for a minute, then we'll leap into this.
Well, like many of us who do this work, our work came out of our experience as doctors, particularly African-American doctors, in inner-city hospitals where we would see young people coming through on a regular basis who didn't have access to medical care in other ways. That is, we didn't see them in primary care. But we often saw them as victims of violence or patients on the surgical wards. And often they were judged to have been the cause of their own injuries. That is, there was a sense that young black men didn't get shot. They got themselves shot. And on the part of my, to be honest with you, I held some of these, some nuanced views of the same type. That is, you know, well, this person must have been doing something that they shouldn't have been doing. But as I began to talk to these young people and to try and design ways that they could get primary care, I began to hear different stories. And that is that many of these young people had been injured in their communities doing the sorts of things that you and I might do. So going to the store late at night to get something or at a party. And so I began to realize that it was the trauma itself that we were overlooking and its effect on the young people who we were seeing.
And but you're not a surgeon. You're a family physician. That's where you started. Internist. But so your sojourn into this was almost, in some ways, insinuating yourself into a world that wasn't your world directly.
Well, the truth is,
in a sense.
But these young people come through the emergency room. They end up on the surgical wards. At some point, they end up in other parts of the hospital, dermatology clinic, or primary care. And so that even when I would see young people who had made an appointment to be seen in primary care, when I put them on the table to do a physical exam, many of them would raise up their shirts to show these long surgical wounds that went from their chest down to their past their belly button. And so in the conversation about routine medical care, we were often finding young people who had suffered brutal violence in their communities. And these are the survivors. So we often talk about homicide when we measure the statistics.
Right.
But the truth is there are orders of magnitude more young people who are victims of violence and who survive as compared with those who die of homicide. And so when you begin to think about the numbers of young people who are affected by violence, it goes far beyond what we can measure in terms of homicide victims.
And describe, before we introduce Roy Martin, I want to talk about how it was introduced in this book and how to bring him to this conversation. Talk a bit about the program you started and how you were meant to approach it, which is a little different than people might expect, I think.
Well, one of the program, the Young Men's Health Clinic
particular,
was our desire to say, could we get these folks who were being seen all over the rest of the hospital into the primary care that you and I would like? And so I began to reach out to other clinics, to people in the community, saying, if you have a young person, a young man in particular, who's not getting medical care, I want you to send him to our clinic, and we can care for them without regard, because we were the city hospital at the time, whether they had insurance or not. But another way of learning came when I realized that it was important to hear the stories of these young people. And so I began to interview them, tape record their interviews, and hear their stories, really asking the fundamental question, what is it like to be shot? What is it like to be stabbed and to find yourself in the hospital? What does that experience do to you, not only while you're in the hospital, and how can we do what we do better, but how does it go with you, like the physical scars? How do the psychological scars go with you back out into the community? And what that might that lead you to do if you have these intrusive symptoms of post-traumatic stress and flashbacks, the same types of symptoms that combat veterans have? What does that do to you back in that same community?
And I want to come back to where you left off, because I think that, again, it's one of those things that we don't think about in terms of the psychological conditions of young people in our communities. We never think about that. But when you two met, Roy Martin, who is in at least three or four different chapters in the book, is or about you, among these other young men as well, you didn't meet in the hospital because you were shot.
No.
Tell us, Roy Martin, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Morgan State University. Are you asking me how we met?
Yeah.
Well, we actually met because I was asked this question very recently, too. but I come from a pretty big family, and, you know, I am very similar to other members of my family, brothers, uncle, my dad. All of us have been in a lot of trouble. My mother as well, a lot of trouble. We all been to prison, mother included. And so, you know, there's a certain wave of law enforcement where they started to, you know, talk about impact players and, you know, people who, you know, on the radar screen by a lot of different branches of law enforcement as well as human service providers. And the goal is, you know, somebody better get one of these young persons, or they can go with you or they can go with us. And so I ended up going to prison for, you know, the some issues that are outlined in the book. And, you know, when I came home, the people who are released are still on the list as well. So they alert the community who's also coming home. So the institution I was in at the time restricted my movement. And so I could only go one place. And the one place I could go was to the program that Dr. Rich was a mentor at, the club program, Careers in Life United in Boston. It was an ABCD Action for Boston Community Development run program. And I had an altercation at the program. It was a little aggressive, number one, because I felt like my options were very limited. I couldn't just say, you know what, you know, screw this program, I'm out of here. You know, I was there on basically I was mandated to be there, and I had travel restrictions. So I could only go one place, and I couldn't leave. So wherever I went, I had to check in. On my way back, I had to check in. So I was stuck there. And to make a long story short, I felt like since I had a problem with this person, like, you know, this is how I'm going to resolve it. So the room pretty much cleared out, except for myself and Dr. Rich. So Dr. Rich was the only person who stayed. And so he and I were talking, and basically I asked him to be my mentor. He asked me, why me? And my answer was, you're the only one that stuck around. You're the only one left. Like, if there was anyone else who was capable of being my mentor, he'd be standing here right now. So all of the adults left. All the people my age left, and so it was just him and myself. You know, he didn't quite agree to be my mentor then, but I explained my situation. I explained how I got to the program, where I left from to come to this program. And he offered, he said, you know, I'll come too. At the time I was at Boston State Pre-Release, he was like, I'll come visit you there if this space is not really comfortable. So he started coming to the pre-release. I was kind of impressed that, first of all, I couldn't really believe he was a doctor because he seemed too young. You know what I mean? And so at the time, I'm like, you know, I guess I didn't know what a doctor really looked like. And so I'm like, you know, this young brother, you know what I'm saying? He's a doctor. So I was like impressed by that. And then the fact that he was a doctor, it's a lot easier to be honest with a doctor. So in my heart, I feel like there are certain places which are probably the most effective or most impactful or appropriate places to ask certain questions. And then there's certain people, I think, who are the best suited to ask a certain question. And I think that a hospital setting or doctors are the best people because you know, like, sort of in your heart, that they're here to help you. They're not here to enforce the law. They're not here to investigate you. There are certain laws that don't allow your doctor to communicate with anybody, any personal details about your treatment or whatever. So it was easy for me to talk to him. And then beyond that, there's certain ways you can kind of see honesty in a person and see kind of, you know, game or BS. And so, you know, once we started talking, he also started to, you know, kind of outline what he was working on and what difficulties he had in his work. And it just was, you know, was a natural kind of Q&A between he and I. And then, you know, we started, you know, our mentorship, our mentee relationship. And then beyond that, like, you know, there were times when he said, you know, why don't you come here with me and help me out with X, Y, Z? So that's how I started.
And John Rich, I mean, from what I read in your book, what happened to you when you met Roy Martin? We'll talk about it a little bit, who, when you decided that you didn't want to be back in the streets in your neighborhood, you would rather go back to this program rather than just be put on parole back into the community. What you learned from Roy, even when you met him in pre-release, even through the time that you knew him at different junctions in his life, these were really eye-opening things for you. His life opened your eyes in many ways.
That's really true. In many ways, Roy has been a mentor to me because Roy and I have had different lives. And I grew up in New York. My dad was a dentist. My mom was a teacher. I went to parochial schools. And so my interest in my in these young people who were coming in was partly born of the fact that they looked like me. They look like African-American. I'm an African-American doctor. These are African-American young men. But I knew that my experience wasn't like theirs. But at the same time as they were being judged by how they looked, I felt some of the sting of that. And so when I met Roy and we began to talk about the things that these interviews were showing me, Roy helped me understand it. Roy helped me put it in context so that I could understand the experience of young people for who I didn't share their same experience. And that was valuable in understanding that the young people I was seeing, some of whom would get deeply involved in violence, were doing so because that was the only identity they could create for themselves. There was no other avenue by which they could be somebody, in their words. And so they figured, well, if I can't be known for doing good, I'll be known for doing bad. And that's a function of having no opportunity. Without having Roy sit with me and help me understand those words that young people had told me, I wouldn't have gotten that part. I was able, I think, to help Roy understand what we were learning about trauma and post-traumatic stress and how those effects were affecting the young people in the community, but also affecting him in many ways, and that the trauma that he had experienced in his life was going with him.
One of the things that really struck me, and I'm going to you to talk about this for a minute, and I'm going to kind of work my way through the other people you've written about in the book, and also especially the experience you two have had together, because and we'll let our listeners figure out a little bit later about how you, Roy Martin, ended up in a place that most young men from where you come from would not end up. But maybe we can talk a bit about how that doesn't have to, should not be, and shouldn't we shouldn't have a world where that's an isolated situation. This should be the norm of the day. We'll get there too. But let me start. One of the things that really shocked you, that may shock a lot of people who read this book, especially middle class, upper middle class folks who read this book, is when you described to John Rich the violence that was inherent in your neighborhood and in your family, and the nature of violence as a survival mechanism, seen as a survival mechanism, by people in poor communities in the inner cities. That, to me, was a really wrenching. I could feel through your words, John Rich, when you wrote it, you were going, what? Huh? You know, as you were describing when you were in your bad days, in the old sense of the word, you know. So just talk a bit about that. I mean, because you grew up in a world where, for you to be who you were, you had to be perceived as the baddest boy on the block.
Well, I guess the best way I can answer that question is, and we talk about this a lot, me and Dr. Rich, that I'm not sure that my job was to be the baddest kid on the block. Mm-hmm. My job was to be a normal kid on the block.
Okay.
All right. Now, my normal was not his normal. Normal where I come from, and I'm not going to lie, there's some brothers walking through these corridors right now. I wish they could come in right now, because I'm certain they could finish my sentences.
They can come if they like.
I would love for them too. All right. Now, I grew up where, and, you know, if somebody, I got eight brothers. If any one of my brothers is fighting anybody, I don't even care if they're winning, my job is to jump in. All right. If somebody, you know, my parents taught me, somebody hit you, hit them back. If they got a brick, you get a stick. If they got a stick, you get a knife. If they got a knife, you know, what's the logical progression, right? So violence wasn't, you know, something I was trying to prove. Violence was normal. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's some of us that we can't go home unless I pot this dude's wig down to the white meat. Like, it's just normal. So my job is to be normal. And so you're abnormal when you don't, you know, sort of respond violently where I come from. So that is one of the things that I had to learn. That's what I had to learn, like, when I started to run into people and, you know, and it's funny. In the book, there's an example where we're in a restaurant.
Right.
We're in a restaurant and somebody is not doing the right thing with our food. Now, this is
funny. Breakfast sandwich. Right.
Exactly. Right. Now, I don't like to sort of stereotype my own people, but if there were certain people in the room right now, they probably would give me a nod, you know. But we don't, there's certain things you just don't do, and you don't play with people's food.
Right.
Right? Now, poor people don't have much, you know what I'm saying? So my clothes, I might kill you over my clothes if, you know, I'm not as refined as, you know, I'm supposed to be. You play with my money, my family, my food, something might happen, right? So this guy, he's not doing the right thing with our food. Dr. Rich notices it, and I'm like, yo, we should check this dude, right? And so he's like, no, we shouldn't. And so I'm like, you know, so in my heart, that was the normal thing to do. That was the normal thing to do. If someone says something to me, you say something back. If someone looks at you funny, you look back. If somebody tries something with you, you go back. If someone shoots your friend, you don't go back in a year. You go back tonight. Like, that was normal. And so for me, I was fitting into the world that I was raised into. My father, that's how my father is. That's how my brothers are. That's how my mother is. Like, so it was a stretch for me to really kind of evolve away from that, because those are things we were all taught. You feel me? That's what I'm saying. I need some folks who might, you know what I'm saying? So I'm like,
you saw the brother outside the glass.
Exactly.
Working
exactly.
His head, yes,
exactly.
Through the glass. Right.
Thank you.
Right.
And so
right.
I'm like, we're taught that stuff. We're taught that. And so when I become a man, I'm like, if there are guns out here, you know, if that's how we're fighting, that's what I use.
So now, let me bring John back, and then we'll get a phone call here before we do a quick break. This is a profound piece. You know, the whole book's profound, but I think that the way it opens up is important.
Yeah.
In your story, as well as the other young man that you found shot in the hospital, which we'll talk about him as well. But because when you're reading this, I think it's important to grab hold of this for a minute, because we talked in the green room about post-traumatic stress disorder and guys, you know, that many of us know or may have known have gone to Vietnam or come back from Iraq or Afghanistan.
Yeah.
What they suffer from because of the violence they perpetrated and experienced and seen and felt. But we never think about it in terms of young people, men and women, boys and girls from the streets, who suffer the same post-traumatic stress. And to grow up in a world where violence is the norm, this is what you do. This is an important point to make in terms of what you're trying to make in your book.
It's important, particularly for those of us who are encountering young people like this in settings where we're supposed to help them. Because first, given where we often come from and are normal, we don't understand the logic, and I use that word deliberately. There is a logic that makes sense given where Roy grew up. Now, it may not be a logic that he wants to continue in his life. But if I don't understand it, then what I end up doing as a doctor is wagging my finger in somebody's face, telling them what I would do and is what they shouldn't do. But the second point, Mark, that you bring up, which is really important, is that violence changes your physical body. It changes your mind, your brain, so that many of the young people who have grown up in violent situations walk around with all of the jumpiness, all of the ready to react that comes with post-traumatic stress. And it isn't simply a matter, and they're left that way by trauma. So no matter what it was that led to them getting injured, they may walk away with a very acute sense that they are not safe. And if you take a person who's not safe and put them right back into the circumstance where they came from, they're likely to do something to try and stay safe. And as Roy said, you know, if somebody came at you with a gun, there may not be, in your mind, much alternative to what you have to do to stay safe. It's also important to remember, because we talked about how homicide underrepresents violence.
Right.
Only 1 in 10 victims of violence who come into the hospital through the emergency department actually get admitted to the hospital. Most of those folks get sent back out with a little bit of treatment of their wounds. So within hours of the time that you were shot or stabbed, you may find yourself back in the community. So we have a whole generation of young people, and in some communities, whole groups of young people who are walking around with, if not full-blown post-traumatic stress disorder, some of the most dangerous symptoms, the symptoms that will lead them to do things like get guns or self-medicate their distress with drugs or alcohol.
I think the question is that if we understand this, what do we do about it? Is what I also want to talk about in the course of this hour. Number is 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to the Mark Steiner Facebook page. You can make your comments there. I'll check that out in a minute. We're here with Dr. John Rich, who's author of Wrong Time, Wrong Place, Trauma and Violence in the Lives of Young Black Men. You just heard him speak. He's chair of the Department of Health Management and Policy at the Drexel University School of Public Health, which is in Philadelphia. And, of course, he's a 2006 MacArthur Grant recipient, often known as the Genius Award, given to people to continue their work. Roy Martin is with us, one of the young men he writes about in this book, who's led a very powerful life of his own, as chronicled in this book. And we're talking about this life as it unfolds. How does someone go from what he's described to working for Senator John Kerry, almost go back, come back, and remain? We'll get to that as well. But let's get a phone call in here first at 410-319-8888. And Ricky in the Inner Harbor, you're on the air, or at the Inner Harbor, I should say. Hope you're not in the Harbor.
I'd like to say good evening to you, Mr. Steiner, and your guests. I was listening, I guess, for about 25 minutes, and mm-hmm. Couldn't help but be impressed by this mentor-mentee relationship, particularly the immense intelligence of the mentee and how he somehow managed to do a self-assessment and be able to articulate in great detail to Dr. Rich his experiences and the analytical concerning those experiences and how Dr. Rich and him interfaced in such a way that allowed them to garner a great understanding of each other and each other's backgrounds. This is really a tremendous story, and I think one that has been successful in terms of a mentor, a positive, respectful, wholesome mentor-mentee relationship. And again, the young man in question, with his obvious intensity and awesomeness of intelligence, I think he can go anywhere in life he wants. And I'm glad that he's directed his life and down a constructive path, and he's channeling his energies down the constructive path. My hat's off to Dr. Rich for taking the time, offering the attention, and offering the encouragement to this young man to succeed and to want to do better and see a life outside of the violent and negative lifestyle that he knew coming up.
Thank you.
Ricky, thank you. I appreciate you being part of the show, and we'll get to the other callers here in a second. I think that one of the things I just want to add on to here before we go to break is that what Dr. John Rich has done in Boston, also in Philadelphia, this started in Boston. John Rich is now in Philly. There's another physician here who came down from Philly, who's on the other side of glass watching the show, who has a program he runs like this in Philly. Carnell Cooper runs one like this in Baltimore, Maryland, at Shock Trauma. there are things going on in L.A. with African-American physicians in those hospitals there as well. And I think that's really a phenomenon we don't talk about enough in America, which is black men who are physicians in America creating these programs to reach out to the young black men they treat from the streets from different worlds. Though some of the physicians themselves may have come from that world, most have not. This is a very powerful movement, so to speak, that I think that we need to give some more credence to and to talk about more on the air, which we'll do. And I learned just a little bit ago that this is not just in Baltimore and from this program, it's all over the country this is happening. So this is really an interesting and a very powerful phenomenon. We're joined by Dr. John Rich, author of Wrong Time, Wrong Place, Trauma and Violence in the Lives of Young Black Men, and Roy Martin, who is one of the men who he writes about in this book, who became his friend and mentee. Actually, as John Rich would say, they're mentee mentors. Case manager at the Boston Public Health Commission. Do we have time? We don't have time for one caller, so we'll come back, take a break. We'll come back and go to James and Jay and Baba. You all are calling to call in. We'll get your voices on the air. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News and World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. We'll be right back. Stay with me. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late, Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. We're joined this hour by Dr. John Rich, author of Wrong Time, Wrong Place, Trauma and Violence in the Lives of Young Black Men. He's chair of the Department of Health Management and Policy at Drexel University School of Public Health in Philly, 2006 MacArthur Grant recipient. Roy Martin is one of the young men he writes about in this book, who is now a case manager at Boston Public Health Commission. It's one of the programs like Carnell Cooper, with physicians reaching out to young men who have been victims of violence that they see in their clinics, in their hospitals, in their shock trauma units. Roy Martin was not one of those men, but they met in another program that was linked to the work that John Rich is doing. The number here is 410-319-8888. Rachel is here at steinershow@gmail.com. Before we go back to the phones, and James and Baba, the next two callers up, and hear what they have to say, is that this program you started, let me go back to the beginning of your book for a moment. There's a young man you write about in the beginning of the book who was shot at the very beginning, and Carrie. And you write about this nurse in this book, and you write about him coming in, and when he comes in on the gurney, how he tries to sit up and say something. Nobody hears him, falls back down or held back down, and tries to say he's cold, the only word you heard him utter. But that you talk to a nurse about what was going on, and this nurse kind of gives you a lecture about you don't understand. I've seen these people. I've seen these men. I know who they are. They're just going to come back. They're basically all thugs, and you know I know what this is about, and don't – and getting in face about that. But that was also an epiphanal moment for you as you saw this young man who, as it turned out, was not part of a criminal act.
Right.
He was a victim of an act. But
that's right. It's a complicated situation because these are healthcare providers, doctors and nurses who are working in emergency departments, and they're trying to save people's lives. So when a person rolls in, a young black man who's dressed in Timberland boots and baggy jeans, there's not much time in that moment to have a conversation because they're really about trying to save that person's life, get them to the operating room within an hour and know that they'll save their lives. But because of that dynamic, those doctors and nurses live in the world. They watch television. They read the newspaper. And it begins to reinforce this idea that the victim's also partly guilty and the victim's a perpetrator. And so the young man we're talking about in the book hadn't ever really spoken a word by that point to any healthcare provider, and yet we felt like we knew him already without ever hearing his story. Now, there are a couple of consequences of that. The first is that we don't believe that there's anything possible And therefore, we don't understand his symptoms of trauma. We don't work to heal what's going on to him with him. But it also begins to reinforce this idea that black men are something not human.
Mm-hmm.
And once we get that thing settled in our heads, then we lose the opportunity to do what we've done here and is happening in Philadelphia, which is we need to engage these young people by our sides as the solution to this problem. So as we do this work in Philadelphia in a program called Healing Hurt People, you made reference to Dr. Ted Corbin earlier, it's really important that the young people who are providing services to victims themselves have had an experience that's the normal that Roy talks about. So they can bring their own experience of having injury, having healed from the trauma, to bring to the victim, but also to help us as providers understand this. We can't possibly understand it unless we hear the voices of these young people themselves. So the transformation isn't only about, let's help this young person change who they are. It's also about us changing how we view them and how we do what we do, both in the healthcare setting and in other settings as well.
Let me open the phones again at 410-319-8888. James, you're on the air.
Yeah, I certainly agree with what they're saying, but I think it takes a whole lot of thoughts and a whole lot of experiences to really deal with this problem because it's so enormous. I'm 74 years old. I had 5-6 fathers. Any one of them slapped me up my head and give my mama some dope. That was my father. I met my real father when I was 32 years old and I was in business. But one thing I would like to say to simplify it a little better, we have 2,000 churches in Baltimore City. And I know some of them take in 50, 60 grand on a Sunday. If each one of those churches brought in 100 kids out of the neighborhood and funded them and getting some kind of training to make that transition, it would change. We don't have black entrepreneurs. The Jews used to hire kids. Every kid worked at the Jew store. Here we had a kid yesterday, 17 years old. He'd been locked up 17 times. He's out on bail for 10 years for murder. And that's what happened. We got 10, 12-year-old kids out here on the street hustling, and what they learned when they're 16 years old, they're already hardened criminals.
Mm-hmm.
So we need some people that have some brains, these guys with these doctorate degrees, and it's like all the preachers have a doctorate degree now, and that's where all the money is and always has been in our community. You know, I remember when the preachers over on Wilson Street would have a thing at 7 o'clock in the morning telling my grandmother to make $5 a car fare that if you give me $4.50 for this cone, you don't have no more migraine headaches.
Mm-hmm.
So I would like to see you bring somebody like me or some other person like me so we can tell you that had really lived it.
Well, I just say, James, that's James and all the other James is always welcome on the show. I mean, that's part of what we have to do, and I mean, you can leave your number with our producer, and I'll be glad to call you when the show is over, and we can talk about that. I'd love to come down, take a walk, and hear what you have to say. And what James was saying, from your perspective, Roy, and also John, does Roy Martin have to be, not to objectify you, but does Roy Martin have to be, have to be an oddity in all this, or do both of you really believe that the majority, let's say, of young men that have gotten to the point of that severe a confrontation with violence, they end up almost dead or shooting somebody, can actually twist and turn and become a different human being? To change, not different human being, can twist and turn and actually live a different kind of life?
Well, if you don't mind, first of all, I just want to salute the brother that just called up, James, I believe his name was. Because I think he actually made a very important point. And I think I agree with him 100%. And, you know, I think what he was trying to suggest was that, you know, mentorship is important. You know what I mean? Like, you can't just, you know, sort of bungee in and out of the life of a young person and think you're going to have some real, you know, lasting impact.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And so, you know, you can import a bunch of professionals into any community, into any life of any young person. But if that person is going to come and go, then that work is not going to last. And it's interesting, like I met Dr. Rich when I was, 21? I'm 40 now. You know what I mean? And he's still my mentor, you know? So we're still in touch. This is lessons that have occurred over, you know, a lifetime. You know what I mean? And so that's what I believe it takes. And when this brother James talked about, you know, he might have had 15 brothers around him that would have popped him in the head if he was out of line. Like, you know, I mean, that's what we kind of need as young people. We need that DP. We need that discipline. You know what I mean? And we need some folks who are wiser than us, more experienced than us, to correct our course when we go off path. And so if I didn't have somebody who had a correct trajectory, you know what I mean? Then how is somebody going to correct my path if your path is incorrect? You know, so when he talks about these churches need to open their doors and bring in like 100 young people, you know, you could bring them in. But my hope would be that these churches also understand that this is a long term plan. And that long term plan is what helps to reinvent someone. When I was 21, I had 21 year old issues. When I was 16, I had 16-year-old issues. I'm 40 now. I got 40-year-old issues.
Right.
So they don't go away. And then every time something pops up that I need some guidance through or need a question answered, I have somebody in an open line that I could call. I'm an adult now. So even if I got to travel down to Philadelphia to get my answer, I can do that as an adult. But kids can't do that. You know what I mean? Like some young people have never been past their corner. So they're not going to go any further than that looking for guidance. So he's right. We need to bring the adults back. We definitely need to bring the adult males back to be the guidance for the younger brothers and help correct our course and understand that that relationship, you know, at best should be long term and not short term.
I mean, the responsibility of men comes back over and over again on this show in terms of the discussions we have.
Well, if you think about it, right, like I tell people this all the time. It's like, you know, when you're a kid, one of the first things you want to do is like, I could slam you. It's like it's the first thing kids do. They want to see how, you know, at what point can they pick you up. And the first person you can slam is your mother. So I'm like, at what age do you start your first confrontation almost is with your mother? It's late on in life when you think you can challenge your father, if you can ever do that. So I think it's not that, you know, there's something that a man could do that a woman can't do, but I think the window of opportunity is much wider when it's a man because, you know, to this day, I'm still kind of afraid of my father. So, you know what I mean? Like, if my father walked through this door right now, I'm going to have to straighten up. You know what I mean? If my mother walked through the door right now, like, I might still be swinging in my chair until, you know, she really get going. So I think it's just a different window and a larger opportunity for a male to have impact.
And in response to that, John Rich, I mean, what Roy Martin just said, he's 21, now 40. So this is important to hear, too, because it one of the most significant things you just said was that you can't do this on the fly. You can't just come in here for a day or two in a young person's life and then walk away. You've been doing this for 20 years, more.
That's right. And what we know is that the most important influence on a child growing up is a caring adult in their lives. And so if we wanted to prevent a lot of the problems that young people have, we would make sure they had a caring adult who was there over the long term. Now, that's often talked about as primary prevention. And there is an idea in some people's heads that we shouldn't do anything for young people once they've hit 16 or 17, that we should sort of give it all over to their responsibility. But we have a responsibility to have a caring adult in their lives as well. You ask the question, can this be repaired?
Right.
Can healing happen for a young person who has suffered the wounds of either not really being taught what was right and what was wrong, not having the guidance of an adult, or having suffered the trauma of seeing their friends gunned down, seeing violence in their neighborhoods, lying in bed and hearing gunfire? We believe it can, but there's no quick fix to this. It requires that we understand the problem, which is in part lack of a caring adult, in part the trauma that changes even how their bodies react. And that we stay with it, believing, partly out of the belief that we can't do this without them. We can't write off a whole generation of young people and believe that we can just keep starting over. And so wherever we're serving young people, their voices have to be with us. So I couldn't do this without Roy. We couldn't do the work in Philadelphia without young people who are really keeping us honest to the realities that young people are facing in the streets.
410-319-8888. Let's go to Yana. You're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Welcome.
Thank you. I was listening to the show. My name is Ayana. I'm a teacher right here in Baltimore, and actually not too far from the campus of Morgan, where I attended my undergrad. But I'm just listening, and it's all of what is being said is true, and I definitely agree with Roy, who was speaking about the fact that there needs to be a lot more male impact on the young males, African-American males in schools. And, of course, you all are probably privy to the fact that a lot of schools we have majority female, myself being one, female teachers, and also a growing number of Caucasian female teachers and all of that. But I'm calling because, I don't know, I think when I think of somebody like Roy who has been through something where they have had, you know, legitimate circumstances to the reason why, the normalcy, as you mentioned earlier, but when I think of somebody like some of my students, I teach at a Catholic school and it's a tuition based. I think of some of the privileges that my students have had and, you know, how their parents are literally paying for them to have an advanced education. And I see some of the, just some of the way that they carry themselves in their deportment and how they act as if they have been or they come from the same situations of many underprivileged African-American youth.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seems to be one that is like it's a popular thing. It's something that is a part of, you know, the culture, almost like it's hip. It's, you know, it's something that's good to, you know, exemplify someone who doesn't care or is apathetic to, you know, schoolwork, to, you know, being progressive. Like I showed a film today in class of, you know, the Civil Rights Movement and how the young people were a part of that and how they had to be so disciplined to be nonviolently and react nonviolently in cases of sit-ins and
right.
other things like that. And it's just such a different mentality, you know, and it's hard to break that. And it's just crazy to me that, you know, and these are some kids who don't know anything about growing up with, you know, mayonnaise sandwiches, and they don't understand, you know, they have their cell phone in their pocket and their iPod, and you know, a two car family, you know, all these things, and I'm like, well, what are you carrying around this chip for, you know? And it's strange.
I you raised something that actually made me think of something that Roy Martin was quoted in the book at one point saying you were really worried about the younger generation. You're 40 now.
Yeah.
And Ayana's talking about the kids who are 15, 16 yeah. years old and younger.
Well, there's one thing I thought about, because I'm not going to lie, sis, when you were talking, my head was just nodding, like, you know, because it is my concern. And, you know, we were talking earlier about, number one, there's a lot about, like, you know, when your search for an identity. And so everybody wants to be important. Like, everybody wants to be famous. And this is one of the things we go back and forth with a lot. It's like sort of fame versus infamy. It's like, if I can't be famous, I'll be infamous, right? So there's something about when you choose to be tough as opposed to, you know, bright or, you know, a real, real social character. It seems like when folks decide to act tough, people usually do that because it is definitely the most achievable thing that you can do. Like, not everybody can be a hero, but anybody can be a bad guy, you know? So, and then in certain communities, like, it's one thing when you talk about, you know, how many opportunities people have out here in the world. Well, when you have a limited amount of opportunities, you also have a limited amount of occupations as well. If you don't have many opportunities, then there's not much you can be. So, and we were just talking about this, and I think it's a Socrates quote that says, you know, the unexamined life is not worth living. Well, in the hood, like, there's certain, you know, persons in the world that just don't, they have no clue what they're going to be. And so that's why kids join gangs. You know what I mean? Because it's like, all right, here I can have an identity. That's why young girls even hook up with pimps. It's like, I have an identity here. You know, somebody gave me value, whether good or bad value. And so a lot of times people behave bad because you're seen when you're bad. Like, I don't care what it is. That's why train wreck TV is so big. That's why reality shows are kicking off real programming now. Like, you know, bad is seen. Bad gets you attention. Attention works. If you're a person and you're an anonymous person, you act up, everybody's going to know your name. And so I think it's an easy identity, which I believe is harmful to our young people, because we're taking an easy route to just have people know your name. And they know your name not for something good, it's usually for something bad, but they know you. And so I think, like, persons like, I believe she said her name was Ayana.
Ayana, yeah.
You know, those are the persons I believe that, like with Dr. Rich and sort of the Dr. Rich Roy Martin experiment, you know, where I think that there's another crowd of persons who need to begin to be prepared, or we need to prepare the next crowd of young people, the young brothers that we see walking in the hallway, the young brothers that's working with Ted at the hospital in Philly. Like, we have to prepare young people so that they're the ones saying, basically, you're not cool to me. You know what I'm saying? Like, the things you're doing are the dumbest things I've ever seen in my life. But those persons have to actually come from, like, that cut of culture that you could be insulted by. Like, if there's someone in your world that you know you could disappoint, you try to stay away from that. If there's someone in this building that you know if you behave a certain way, they're going to look at you as unattractive. Well, if we start at least illustrating to our young people, like, we view you as unattractive for doing those things, and people that they are looking for approval from will stop doing it. Like, none of us would thug if we thought girls would run from us for it. You know what I'm saying? So I'm like, the people who we're trying to impress have to stop behaving like we are not impressed by that. And, you know, I'm sorry, but if someone walked through here with the biggest gold chain in the game, he's going to get some play for it. And so we need to start realizing, like, those things are real. Kids see them things. It's an easy way to get noticed and get famous. And so, therefore, we do it.
And Roy taught me this when I had met a young guy named Jimmy in the book who had been shot a number of times and was lying in the hospital. And he began to explain to me that he could be known. He could have a reputation if he used violence, because then he would be known by everybody. And it was his way to be somebody. Young people who don't see another way to be somebody will choose something that's in reach. The easy thing is to be tough. But it's also true that we've somehow glamorized the idea of being shot, or we've glamorized this idea of being a thug, which is also a very dehumanizing way to think about young black men. We think about them either as, you know, cool because they're so tough, or as criminals because they're so tough. And so all of our efforts in having voices like Roy's is to say it's not so simple. We can't make it that, you know, this is what a young black man is. But rather, we have to see what the potential is and what we can help to foster.
It's just for our listeners, before we go back to these other callers calling in, John Rich, I mean, talk about how you and I think it's Ted Corbin, right, the physician from Philly who's across the glass, and other men like you, do what you do. I mean, physicians are notoriously some of the busiest human beings on the planet Earth, with, you know, in terms of the work you do, taking care of human beings medically. So talk about how you do what you do and what that is.
We do what we do because we have a passion for believing that we can help these young people to heal. What that means in the emergency department at Hahnemann Hospital and Healing Hurt People is that when a young person comes in who's been shot or stabbed, we don't just patch them up and send them out, but we have someone come and talk to them. And the intervention at that point is as simple as this. Number one, are you safe when you leave here? Let me tell you about some symptoms you might have, some feelings that you might have that are going to throw you off, but they're normal. So you might have flashbacks. You might have nightmares. You might feel unsafe. Don't go buy a gun. Don't smoke a lot of weed. But if you're feeling, you know, if you feel bad, come back and we'll help you. So there's that, just orienting them and caring for them in that moment. But we then assess what they're feeling. We have a navigator, a case manager like Roy, someone who's had the experience in their own life, to go out and see the young person in their home, figure out how to help that young person get an ID, which many of the young people we see don't have identification. They can't access services without identification.
Right.
How can I help you get a job? How can I help you deal with the amount of weed that you smoke? And then pulling young people together in groups where they can talk about their trauma and help one another heal. The young people that Dr. Corbin saw in the emergency department said, I know I need some help, but I can't see myself sitting with a therapist. But I'll sit with a group of my peers in a facilitated group to talk about my life experience and how I can heal. And so putting those together, the goal is to ease the distress and the pain that these young people have that often drives them back to violence or situations where they could be wounded. And one of the things that we talked about earlier is the fact that violence recurs. So in some studies, up to 45% of people who have been shot or stabbed get shot or stabbed again in the next 5 years. So when we can intervene with a young person who's been injured, we're preventing death and future injury in the future. And that's the passion of the work. The truth is, though, we often are fighting against the impression that this is hopeless.
Right.
And so a lot of our work is making a case to policymakers, to hospital administrators, to public health leaders that this is a population of young people for whom trauma is a key issue and we have to address it.
So, and you, we only have a couple minutes left here. I'm sorry, but I wish we had more time to do this. But Roy Martin, because your route was really—I mean, you went through a lot of bumps here.
Yeah.
You almost didn't come back. You fell back in the community. Even if you got a job with John Kerry, you came back, and for all kinds of reasons, people can read the book and find out more about your life that way. But your job now, if I understand what you were just saying, is working with young men who are like you.
Exactly. Yep, and it's funny because we were just talking about this, me and Uncle Ralph in the background. But one of the things we were talking about was that, you know, I am what they are and I am what they also want to be. And what I mean by that is, like, you know, I do have a career path now. I have custody of my children now.
Good.
I'm married now. I own my property now. And so it's difficult for, you know, a full-blown goon to tell me, well, I can't do this because of my record. I'm like, well, I wouldn't be sitting here right now if it's impossible to hurdle that. Well, I can't do, you know, and I'm like, how is that possible? And then the biggest thing is that a lot of young people feel like, you know, I'm from Bromley Heath Projects, born and raised. We have issues with, you know, another neighborhood historically in Boston called Academy Homes. 20 years.
Well, I'm sorry. We have to break out. I have to break in the middle of your thought.
I got you.
Roy Martin is case manager of the Boston Public Health Commission. Great to have you. Good to meet you, man.
Thank you very much.
You came out alive in this book. And in your whole life, it's wonderful. The book we're talking about is Wrong Time, Wrong Place, Trauma and Violence, The Lies of Young Black Men by Dr. John Rich, who was also a MacArthur Grant recipient in 2006. It's really a well-written book. And one of the reasons it's a well-written book, because he was an English major before he became a doctor. So it's a really easy book to read as well. So good to have you both here. Thank you so much for both what you do.
It's great
to have you in the studio.
Thank you.
The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Heart Center, where expert cardiologists, cardiac surgeons, nurses, and support staff have built a nationally recognized program focused on prevention, treatment, and rehabilitation. For a virtual tour of a heart center, go to www.umm.edu/heart. We'll be right back with more of a similar conversation, a little different tact. Stay with us.